From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 123, The Tallest Lighthouse of the Evergreen State. When Captain Robert Gray, an American fur trader sailing on the Columbia Rediviva, entered the wide bay on Washington's outer shore that would become known as Gray's Harbor on the 7th of May, 1792, it was a watershed moment in the history of the Evergreen State. He stayed until the 11th of May in that location. Bullfinch Harbor was originally named in honor of Charles Bullfinch, one of the investors in his fur trading operation. The renowned English seafarer Captain George Vancouver, while exploring the Pacific Northwest with the ships Discovery, sloop Chatham, and store ship Daedalus in April of that year, came across Gray off the coast of Cape Flattery. When the Discovery went through Gray's Harbor in October of 1792, Vancouver dispatched Daedalus in one of the ship's boats to investigate. Daedalus had to wait 3 days before it was able to successfully cross the bar into the harbor. The Discovery's boat, under the supervision of sailing master Joseph Whidbey, conducted a survey of the harbor. He gave the island's most prominent features names, including Point Hanson on the southern point, in honor of James Hanson, a lieutenant in the Vancouver militia. Gray's Harbor was designated on Vancouver's charts, which were first published in 1798 and depicted the area. That was the moniker that stuck, though the possessive astrophe was dropped later in usage. While conducting surveys of America's Pacific coastline between San Francisco and the Strait of Juan de Fuca in 1850, surveyors rapidly identified Gray's Harbor as a port with considerable potential. The vast, sheltered bay, which was located around 40 miles north of the Columbia River's entrance and 93 miles south of the Puget Sound's entrance, provided access to the Chehalis River and its tributaries. The river, in turn, was navigable for a considerable distance all the way to the timber-rich mountainsides of the Olympic Peninsula and the potentially productive farmlands of the lowlands and foothills below those peaks. Gray's Harbor was a distant and poorly populated place in the 1850s, despite the promise of the gold rush. Mariners were hesitant to cross the treacherous bar at the bay's mouth. Only a handful of settlers made a meager livelihood on the coastline. A lighthouse at Gray's Harbor was one of just 16 such facilities suggested by the Coast Survey for the Pacific Northwest coast of the United States in the middle of the 19th century. Though, it was given a low level of importance. However, on the 11th of September, 1854, the federal government designated Gray's Harbor as a lighthouse reservation. The reservation encompassed both capes, Point Hanson, and its northern tip opposite Point Brown, as well as the surrounding area. Washington Territory residents wrote to Congress in 1858 pleading that Gray's Harbor be surveyed by the government and buoys erected to indicate the passage, and that Gray's Harbor also be designated as a port of entry. The pleas of the people were not immediately answered by Congress. Gray's Harbor didn't start to live up to its potential until the 1880s, when the railroad finally arrived. First, there were the vacationers. After settling at Point Hanson, Elijah Wade, a Civil War veteran, began conducting summer reunions of the Grand Army of the Republic, a fraternal organization of former Union soldiers, in a place known as Cohasset Beach, about a mile south of the future site of Gray's Harbor. The number of Grand Army tourists dwindled, and as a result, he made accommodations for those who wished to spend a few days or weeks by the sea clamming, fishing, and gingerly venturing off the surf-pounded beaches. As a result of this development, little settlements built up near the mouth of Gray's Harbor. This group of people provided services to what was becoming a prosperous logging sector. Gray's Harbor had risen to become the most important timber port in the United States by 1890. Gray's Harbor shipyards built 9 steamers and 3 sailing vessels in that year, and the region's 13 timber mills shipped 66 million board feet of lumber on 256 different vessels. The Northern Pacific Railroad also decided to build a spur line out to Gray's Harbor. Tracks were finished in 1892, connecting Point Hanson with the newly established settlement of Ocosta-by-the-Sea, which was just a few miles east. Despite the fact that the Northern Pacific eventually abandoned Ocosta as a rail terminus, economic development continued as the United States Army Corps of Engineers began to devote millions of dollars into strengthening Gray's Harbor's navigational capabilities. These early years of development undoubtedly influenced the House of Representatives Committee on Commerce to suggest a $15,000 funding for the construction of a lighthouse on Point Hudson in the following year. The appropriation was approved by Congress in July of 1884. At this point, the Lighthouse Board determined that a small harbor light rather than a more expensive first-class light was required for safety reasons. It was the former that served as harbors, whilst the latter were intended to occupy headlands along the coast to aid the mariner in avoidance of perils that he may meet while in their neighborhood and in deciding his course from one place to another according to their description. While talks for the purchase of a harbor light site were underway, the Lighthouse Board obtained more evidence that led them to the conclusion that Grace Harbor deserved a first-order light. In 1886, the board petitioned Congress to extend the original appropriation by $60,000 in order to construct a first-order light at the entrance to Grace Harbor. The request would eventually be granted, and the money was appropriated by Congress in 1895. Beginning in 1897, work was started on the Grace Harbor Lighthouse. Officials from the 13th Lighthouse District chose a site that faced the Pacific Ocean and was approximately 400 feet from the water's edge. The site was 2.5 miles south of the extreme tip of Point Hanson or Point Chehalis. Constructing a wagon route across the Point Chehalis Peninsula from a landing on the eastern or protected side of the peninsula to the lighthouse location was the first step. Due to this, the delivery of building materials was made much easier. Their next step was to dig out an area 12 feet deep in the dunes to serve as a foundation for what would eventually become a 107-foot-tall tower coated with cement. Observers in places such as Aberdeen, Cosmopolis, Grace Harbor City, and Hoquiam, which are located about 20 miles distant, were able to track the development of the project as the conical tower with 4-foot-thick walls at its base gradually grew in height and became more visible. Both to the north and south of the lighthouse, two small oil storage sheds with a combined capacity of 685 gallons or a year's supply of oil were located on the same plot of land. Landward, or east of the lighthouse, construction began on two residences for the keeper's families, one for the head keeper and his family, and another for the assistant. There was also a fog signal facility constructed just west of the lighthouse and slightly closer to the sea. The building of the lighthouse was delayed until 1898 due to delays in shipping critical components. By the time it was completed, the lighthouse had 135 iron steps and a circular staircase running from the base of the tower to the service room, which was the first of 3 levels on the lighthouse's top. The next level up was the observation room. Keepers were able to regulate the flow of air to kerosene lamps, which served as a light source before the building was converted to electricity. Located on this level was also the clockwork mechanism that operated the light until it was replaced by an electric motor. In the lantern room above, there was a third-order Fresnel clamshell lens made in Paris in 1895 by Henry Lepot and Sons, which was balanced on a pedestal. A 20-gallon pool of mercury in the watchroom served as the base for the light, allowing the lens to be rotated easily. It was ready for operation when Christian Zahner, who was appointed as the first keeper of Grace Harbor Light, his wife Hermine, and 2 daughters arrived on the 14th of June, 1898 from the lighthouse at Destruction Island. On the evening of the 30th of June, 1898, authorities from the 13th Lighthouse District and dignitaries from the surrounding community met to dedicate and commission the light. Its first signature consisted of a 5-second white flash followed by a 5-second black flash before ending with a 5-second red one. After electricity arrived at the lighthouse, the signature changed to white flashes followed by 15 seconds of darkness, followed by red flashes and another 15 seconds of darkness. The equipment for the fog signal building took a long time to arrive, and the fog signal did not begin operating until March of 1898 when the weather improved. A small steam engine provided the energy for twin trumpets that aimed out to sea, which were supplied with water pumped by a windmill. When the trumpets sounded, the steam engine's boiler burnt up to 200 pounds of coal every hour. Zahner stayed as head keeper at Grace Harbor until he retired at the end of July 1925. The fog signal building was destroyed by a fire in 1916. An oil-fired boiler was installed in its place. However, despite being located closer to the harbor entrance, the new fog signal building was finally destroyed by coastal erosion in a hot zone. Due to erosion from the sea, the terrain became unstable and the building eventually sank into the sea. The Coast Guard relocated its radio antenna towers in the area to a more inland location. The sea eventually receded from the lighthouse itself and accretion expanded the beach further out into the ocean. By the late 1960s, when the Coast Guard automated the lighthouse stood 3,000 feet from the water's edge surrounded by scrubby beech pines. The lighthouse was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1977. Henry LePout's Fresnel lens was replaced with a tiny electronic optical device in 1992, while the 1895 mechanism at the top of the lighthouse remained in place. Throughout the 1990s, tourists continued to flock to the lighthouse. Throughout the year, volunteers from the Westport South Beach Historical Society, which operates as the Westport Maritime Museum, conducted informal tours of the lighthouse. It was in 1998 when officials from the Coast Guard awarded the Maritime Museum a formal authorization to offer tours of the Grace Harbor Lighthouse. The Coast Guard relinquished possession to the Maritime Museum in June of 2004, and the museum now welcomes visitors on a daily basis throughout the summer and on weekends during most of the winter months. The light and foghorn will continue to direct boats and ships into the harbor for the foreseeable future. I'd be remiss if I did not talk about the town the lighthouse calls home, Westport. The present-day Westport was originally inhabited by members of the Chehalis tribe. Fish was a primary food for the Chehalis, who also built longhouses with one end open to the water for simple salmon gathering. Diseases like smallpox and malaria spread as non-Indians arrived. But the Chehalis tribe was not truly decimated by sickness until 1853, when the newcomers began to settle on their land. The Big Sick was a smallpox outbreak that started on a boat in Nia Bay. The community of Chehalis was all but abandoned due to this, and thousands of people perished. David Douglas, a Scottish botanist and naturalist, traveled to Point Chehalis in 1825 while gathering plants along the Pacific coast. Douglas and his Native American guide set up camp on the point after experiencing some difficulty with an old knee problem, only to be invited to rest at a Chehalis camp across the water. New settlers gradually arrived. William O'Leary, an Irish immigrant who arrived in Washington in 1848, is listed as one of the earliest in Ruth McCausland's Washington's Westport. The first company owner in the region is listed as Ben Armstrong. In 1852, Armstrong constructed a sawmill that turned out to be quite helpful for the expanding population that was in need of homes and boats. After racing to California in search of gold but finding none there, many people looked for a location to settle. The Oregon Donation Act of 1850 gave citizens a decent deal on enormous territory in the area. The remaining Chehalis were forced away as the newcomers settled down and made themselves at home. Isaac Stevens requested the Quinault, Queets, Cowlitz, Shoalwater, and Chehalis tribes to give up their land rights and move onto a reservation in 1855 on behalf of the U.S. government. The offer was serious in that it didn't guarantee that the reservation would be on their ancestral land. When the Chehalis declined, they were classified as a non-treaty tribe, which meant that non-Indian settlers could still claim their property and that the government would not compensate the Indians. Eventually, a plot of land in what is now Grace Harbor County's southeast was given to the Chehalis. Glenn and Jane Peterson and their three-year-old son Frank were the first long-term non-Indian residents of Point Chehalis. They moved into a home left vacant by a previous settler in the late 1850s and spent the remainder of their lives in what would become Westport. The region was known as Point Chehalis during the Peterson family's early years, but by 1879, the town of Chehalis, located southwest of Olympia, had already been established, prompting Point Chehalis to seek distinction. In honor of the first permanent non-Indian settlers, the town was given the name Peterson. The name would eventually be changed once again to that of its current name, Westport, in 1891. The National Life-Saving Service was founded in 1871, and as a result, one of Westport's most permanent improvements was made. For the purpose of aiding distressed ships at sea, several stations were built along the Washington coast. A station was established in 1897 near the future site of Westport. The life-saving station was upgraded in 1898 to include light and fog indications. Westport was already being advertised as a sort of summer vacation resort at the turn of the 20th century. The people of Westport are getting ready to host more guests this season than ever before, according to a 1902 Seattle Times article. It goes on to further state, "The season has already begun and every boat unloads health and pleasure seekers." But the town wasn't only a tourist destination, and some people started calling for technological advancements to match its position as the hub of the Grace Harbor shipping and mill industries. Private maritime firms pooled money in 1908 to build a wireless telegraphic system that allowed for quick and simple communication between Westport and Aberdeen. With 133 buildings included, the United States Geologic Survey map from 1913 indicated some notable increase in the town. The citizens of Westport decided to incorporate on the 16th of June 1914. There were 112 votes cast in all, 96 in favor of incorporation and 16 against. Although he later resigned due to allegations that he lived beyond the municipal limits, Lloyd Cook was elected as the town's first mayor. William Ingram was installed as his replacement by the municipal council following the discrepancy. Another mayoral dispute erupted in Westport in 1923 when the incumbent Gustav Nielsen, also referred to as Nielsen in news reports, refused to hand over the reins to F.M. Smith. Even though Smith won by a slim margin, Nielsen contended that Smith hadn't officially run for office and was instead relying on unofficial results to support his own victory and the victories of many other council members. City records indicate that Fred Smith did indeed win the 1925 election. He served as mayor until 1928. Along with its notoriety for a confusing cycle of mayors, Westport rose to prominence as a whaling hub in the 1920s. In a little under 2 months, the Grace Harbor whaling fleet reportedly caught 54 whales, according to a Seattle Times article from June of 1920. Throughout Westport's early history, fishing had been a significant source of revenue. Commercial tuna fishing began offshore in 1937. Some fishing seasons were significantly more fruitful than others. In 1943, one schooner reported bringing home a haul of shark livers worth a staggering $16,000 in a single voyage. In order to defend against further Japanese attacks following Pearl Harbor, the United States Army erected gun emplacements and sent soldiers to Westport at the start of the Second World War. Some soldiers, along with their horses, were even stationed at a time at what would eventually become the popular Twin Harbor State Park. They were there to patrol the beaches and to report any suspicious activity along the coast. After dark, lights were forbidden, and according to McCausland's Washington's Westport, the Coast Guard had difficulty responding to distress calls because it was so gloomy. The troops left Westport within a few months of the war's end, but that didn't stop a burgeoning wartime economy. To feed soldiers stationed at other camps across the Evergreen State, the Army ordered massive quantities of salmon and halibut, and fishing boats from Grace Harbor quickly filled the order. When a basin was excavated in town to make additional room for mooring, fishing soon became even more significant to the local economy. Commercial and sport fishing vessels were introduced by improvements to the Westport Marina, and by the end of the 1940s, their operation had become successful enough to support two stores, two fish packing plants, a tavern, and a restaurant. The Army Corps of Engineers made enhancements to the harbor safety in the 1950s and early 1960s. There were now 646 docking berths total, including 63 private areas, thanks to the addition of floats. The Grace Harbor Pilots Association was established in the 1970s. Grace Harbor still has pilot boats stationed at Westport that are used to unload a pilot to an oncoming ship to direct the vessel into the harbor. In order to keep up with the catch, canneries, either as fresh fish dealers or industrial processors, became a significant industry in Westport. But commercial and sport fishing were severely impacted as the 1970s got underway. Following the Bolt decision in 1974, which granted native treaty tribes the right to half of the annual catch, restrictions such as a 2-fish limit per day and a shorter fishing season infuriated non-native operators. In 1976, 38 Westport commercial fishermen were issued a contempt penalty for violating a rule prohibiting fishing before the 1st of July by going out on the water on the 28th of June. A court judgment that reiterated American Indian fishing rights led to the prohibition by allowing more salmon to reach Native American fishing grounds. The fishing business in Westport was forced to scramble as fishing seasons shortened. Grace Harbor was one of only three Evergreen State counties to see population decline in the 1980s. When an ocean salmon fishing restriction was implemented in 1994 for a year in response to declining salmon populations, the reality of the situation became even more obvious. Federal help contributed $16 million in disaster relief to communities severely affected by the prohibition, while Westport and other marine-centric towns struggled to find an economic equivalent for the salmon haul. The pricey boats being built by Westport Shipyard Inc. have proven to be a benefit for Westport's economy. The business was started in 1964 as a producer of salmon and crab boats. The luxury yacht sector then expanded significantly between 1998 and 2003 as it transitioned into composite leisure vessels. The company increased its workforce from 70 to 400, and as a result, it now has locations in both Hoquiam and Port Angeles. Grace Harbor and the town of Westport started to see a glimmer of optimism and new development as the turmoil of the fishing issues of the 1990s came to a close in the 2000s. When the population surpassed 2,000, Westport's charter boats started looking for new fisheries to pursue. Rockfish, lingcod, tuna, and even shrimp and crab fishing started to take over. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include the Westport South Beach Historical Society, LighthouseFriends.com, ExperienceWestport.com, Washington's Westport by Ruth McCausland, HistoryLink.org, the National Park Service, the Washington State Historical Society, Lighthouse Digest, and WashingtonLighthouses.org. Thank you for listening to episode 123, The Tallest Lighthouse of the Evergreen State. Episode 124 will be released next week. A special thank you goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the whole. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck. The singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck. And Moklips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.